I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, our governors, the new Congress, making change where Washington can't. But first, authorities in Austria say they've uncovered a major international child pornography ring involving more than 2,000 suspects, including at least 600 here in the U.S., who paid to view internet videos of young children being sexually and painfully abused. An Austrian police expert on internet crime said the children in the videos were under the age of 14. Well, we want to turn to reporter Carrie Skyring in Vienna with a warning that he may have disturbing information. And Carrie, I understand, first of all, that officials don't know who these children are?
No. What we know is that they were produced, or these videos were produced somewhere in Eastern Europe, perhaps in Russia. Certainly the people who paid to view them were paying money to a Russia-based internet website. The police have told me here that some of the images are quite shocking. The children range in age from 5 to 14. There were a total of 8 videos, different children in each of the videos. In one, screams are heard, and a policeman said it looks as though a girl is being raped.
Well, we understand these videos were watched by 600 suspects in the U.S., several hundred more in Germany. How far-reaching is the ring alleged to be?
Police monitored this site. Once they had the tip-off that this material had been uploaded to a Vienna-based server, they monitored the site for 24 hours. During that time, there were 8,000 or more than 8,000 hits from around the world. In total, 77 countries were represented there. As you said, 600 in the United States, but 400 in Germany. France is looking into about 100 there, and there were at least 23 suspects in Austria. So this was an example, and I think perhaps one of the most stunning things to come out of this is just how many people logged on in such a short period of time, and how widespread around the world was the demand for this material.
Which, of course, means they've been logging on at other times as well. Well, we understand you said the police got a tip. We understand the investigation began in July when a man who worked for a Vienna-based internet company thought he saw something suspicious during his routine work. What is expected to happen now? I mean, will there be arrests? What is expected to happen?
Yes, that's what we'll follow up. Police have been able to trace back to those who logged on because they were tipped off. They can follow back through IP computer addresses to those who logged on. And in Austria, what's happened is those people have been searched. Some are under arrest. Some have admitted to downloading the material. Others are being charged under Austria's child pornography laws, and jail sentences are expected. So Austrian police provided this information to the other countries whose citizens were represented amongst those who logged on. And in the United States, the FBI is investigating, and in Germany, of course, police there. So wherever people logged on from, it depends on individual countries as to the action police are taking. But certainly, these investigations are well underway. One would expect that arrests are being made.
And as we said, hundreds of arrests potentially. And what about the makers of the site? Have they been tracked down?
No. And one of the Austrian criminal investigation police here told me that dealing with the Russian police is not as easy as it could be, but an investigation is underway in Russia. Russia has shut down this internet site. They're hoping that they're able to trace via the money trail who produced the material, or at least who was collecting the money for it. So people paid around $89 for viewing this material. They're hoping to trace who that money was paid to and thus make some arrests. But as yet, there is no news of that.
And perhaps in so doing, find the children.
Yes, that, I guess, would be the ultimate aim of this. And the police here couldn't have described it in more graphic terms, just how distressing this was. And they say that most of the child pornography material on the internet that they're seeing at the moment is coming out of Eastern Europe. They say also Southeast Asia, parts of Asia are also producing this material. But it is in Eastern Europe that much of it is being produced.
Reporter Carrie Skyring in Vienna, Austria, where authorities announced today they've uncovered a huge international internet child pornography ring. Carrie, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, now to the question, how are the nation's governors faring? This year's crop of state House executives are often taking on issues once left to Washington policymakers. In Colorado, Democrat Bill Ritter made his theme energy independence. He calls it today's version of the space race. North Dakota's Republican governor called for overseas trading partners in his State of the State speech. West Virginia's governor, a Democrat, announced a state-funded website for consumers to compare health care costs. And, of course, there's Arnold in California, a Republican, calling for universal health care and tougher emission standards. There are 11 new governors in all, and one leading analyst, Alan Rosenthal of Rutgers University, says this means there's a collective momentum that will make this year different from others. So today, in the first of an occasional series, we're going to take a look at two state houses. We start with Ted Strickland, the newly elected Democratic governor of Ohio. Governor, welcome.
Good to be with you.
And let's start with sort of an overview. After the National Governors Association met in November, Deval Patrick, the newly elected governor here in Massachusetts, said it was so good to have colleagues in other states facing the same challenges. What are some of the things that you talk about as having in common?
Well, certainly the need for economic growth and living wage job creation, the need to improve education and make it affordable and of high quality, and the need to provide health care to our citizens without making our businesses and corporations non-competitive. So health care, education, and economic growth and development are the three major issues that I face as governor, and I think many other governors face those same concerns.
Well, let's start with the education, because as you know, many governors are calling to cut property taxes. In your state, this becomes an issue because property taxes fund schools. Now, if I got this right, the state Supreme Court has ruled that this formula hurts students in poorer districts. So a coalition of educators and parents have proposed a constitutional amendment to change the formula, and they want it to be a referendum so voters will decide. Where do you stand on this issue? Because isn't that tricky? Where else would the money come from?
Well, it is obviously tricky, but it is also true that for more than 10 years, Ohio has kept a system of school funding that our Supreme Court has on four occasions said was unconstitutional. And I believe as governor, I've got a responsibility to deal with the nature of this unconstitutional system.
Well, in fact, the state's Republican House Speaker told the Toledo Blade that he expects in your new budget proposal, you'll have a new formula.
Well, I think the Speaker may be playing some political games there. The fact is that I've got a responsibility, but so does the Speaker and the other legislative leaders of our state. This is a shared responsibility, and we are all responsible for making sure that Ohio has a system that is constitutional, that is adequately funded. I want to focus on two things when it comes to education. I want to focus on reforming our system so that we do make the changes that are necessary to put in place high standards and to provide the resources necessary for our students to meet those standards. So it's a matter of reforming our system and adequately funding our system.
Can you give us a hint? Do you think it will be property taxes or cuts in other services? Where do you think the money will come from?
Well, here again, the question is on the funding, and I understand why you've asked that question, because it is central, but I believe we can only achieve a constitutional system of funding that is adequately supported by the people of Ohio as we talk about what they're going to get for their dollar and what changes we're going to make in the system of education that's going to produce the kind of outcomes that will enable the taxpayer to feel good about spending the money. And so I'm beginning a series of conversations throughout Ohio with all of the stakeholders so that we can hopefully develop a consensus regarding what we must do to have a high-quality system of education that is available to all Ohio children. And then I believe there will be the will there to provide the resources necessary to implement that system.
Right, because as you know now, 65% of voters say they want to, you know, have an amendment and change the way it's done now. Well, let's move on to another topic that's a national topic, ethanol. An Ohio major corn producer, critics have said Ohio may be late in the game in terms of ethanol production, but as you well know, others are saying ethanol isn't the answer as an energy alternative. It drives up the price of corn, hurts other industries. and you know that it may produce more problems than it replaces. So where are you on ethanol?
Well, ethanol is a part of the solution to our energy problems, and in the first 6 months of my governorship, I'm going to have a large energy summit that will bring together experts from not only across Ohio but around the country, and perhaps even some international experts, to talk about what we can do in Ohio. I am proposing that we set aside $250 million of our federal bonding authority to invest in new and alternative energy sources. Ohio has great natural resources. We do grow a lot of corn. We grow a lot of soybeans. We are the third leading user of ethanol fuel products. We currently have 5 ethanol fuel facilities under construction in Ohio. We have started late in this effort, but we're going to catch up. We're going to use our abundant coal reserves. We're going to use our agricultural products. In certain parts of Ohio, wind power is very feasible, economically feasible. Mm-hmm. And so we want to have the broadest portfolio of energy research, innovation, and production possible. And I believe Ohio is strategically positioned, both in terms of the geography that we occupy, in terms of our natural resources, and in terms of the history of manufacturing and innovation in Ohio that will enable us to leapfrog, hopefully, if not to the front of the pack, near the front of the pack in the states that are, you know, that are taking seriously these renewable energy possibilities.
And Governor Strickland, just one last question in the minute we have. As you well know, Ohio had been at the center of controversy in the last presidential election. Many people convinced that problems with the way the voting system is set there helped sway the election in George Bush's favor. That is a perception. We just a few seconds now. How are you going to make sure your state it won't have that same accusation in 08?
Well, I think it's an accurate perception that our former Secretary of State was very unwise in interjecting himself in the most partisan way in the last presidential election. Thankfully, we have a new Secretary of State. She is a person, Jennifer Bruner, who is superbly qualified. She knows election laws. She is committed to having open, fair, honest elections. She's going to be auditing the voting machines in Ohio. We're going to make sure that we have in place for the 2008 presidential election a system that will give the people of Ohio and the people of America great confidence that the person who wins the presidential election, and we believe that will be in large part because of Ohio's involvement in that election, will win that election in a fair, free, and honest manner.
And we rush to say, Governor Strickland, that you are the newly elected Democratic governor of Ohio, so perhaps you would want to say that it will be different this time around. And we will all be watching. Governor Strickland, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me. Bye-bye.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, who's running Florida? Someone they're calling quite a character, as you'll hear. This is Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and today we're checking in on new governors, how their agendas might reflect what's happening at the national level. In Florida, Republican Governor Charlie Crist took office and almost immediately faced an emergency and national television cameras as tornadoes struck central Florida last week, killing 20 people and destroying more than 400 homes. Today, Governor Crist took part in a tabletop drill to prepare for the next potential disaster, but how prepared has he seemed as governor? Mark Caputo covers Florida politics for the Miami Herald. He joins us from Tallahassee. Welcome.
Thank you.
And, you know, just give us a quick headline. How's Governor Crist seem to be doing?
Governor Crist is reflecting the modern Republican Party in Florida and perhaps in part in the nation. It's a Republican Party that's kind of turned 180 degrees and has a sense that government sometimes is the solution and is no longer perceived as the problem. It kind of turns Ronald Reagan's aphorism on its head. He's not really wed to an ideology. He's a very moderate Republican. There's a lot of very conservative Republicans around here who are grumbling that he's a liberal Democrat in disguise and that they basically elected a Democratic wolf in Republican sheep clothing.
Well, he probably also, as many other candidates did, probably had an eye on all the Democrats who were moving into statehouse offices, and that may have gone a ways to moderate some of the Republican governors?
Indeed. What makes Charlie Crist very special and interesting is that he has a real intuitive sense about which way the crowd is going to move, and he starts going that way beforehand, and suddenly he's the leader.
Well, how did he handle the tornado crisis, and how did that set the tone for his administration?
Jeb Bush had helped continue a long-standing Florida tradition after Hurricane Andrew in 92 of having a good emergency management response system. It's kind of almost a turnkey operation. But what Chris brought to the table that's different is this very emotive, intuitive, instinctual sense. He's a real people person. I saw him in a parking lot in Lady Lake while I was typing a story. I looked up at a gas station. He's going in the gas station. I hustled in. There he is buying a gallon of milk, 3 pints of Similac, 5 Dandy brand Cuban sandwiches so that he can go feed a family. And there were people there who thought, oh, he wouldn't do this. And he just ponied up his own money. He saw these people suffering. He did what he could at the moment.
Was there a sense that he was doing it? I mean, and I don't mean this.
Sure,
you know,
a publicity stunt is what you're... Yeah, a publicity stunt, perhaps. But the fact is that he delivers consistently on these kind of people-oriented measures. He's a guy who doesn't want to be called governor. He wants to be called Charlie. He passes out his cell phone numbers to sanitation workers and newspaper deliverymen.
Let's touch on some of the things that have happened. We spoke of the tornadoes, and that brings to mind an issue that's resonating across the country, especially in the wake of Hurricane Katrina next door to you. That's insurance reform. Lawmakers in Florida passed a bill that would lead to lower rates. Tell us more about this and why that's so important in Florida.
The legislature, again, in this 180-degree turn for Republicans, decided to have more government control, more government regulation, more government running of a government-run insurance company. It's more of an ideological kind of shot across the bow, saying, I will stand very strongly against the insurance industry.
Well, so there's a lot of words flying in Florida over insurance, but what about immigration? We remember when the newly elected governors met in West Virginia in November. They had a press conference, and one of the things they did was criticize Congress for failing to pass, a comprehensive immigration plan. Where does Crist stand on this issue?
A better question is, where do Republicans in Florida stand on this issue? You have so many immigrants here and such a strong Cuban-American influence in the Republican Party that the tone is much more moderate.
Well, let's take a quick look at the voting system in Florida, because obviously it's, infamous in some ways across the country. After the hanging chads of the 2000 presidential elections, Florida switched to electronic voting machines. Some districts used fill-in-the-blank optical scan forms. Others used touchscreen. But Crist has promised to spend $32.5 million to replace the touch screens because they don't provide a paper trail, which has become a big issue. How important is it for him to get this right?
Well, for us in the media, it's almost bad because we're going to be without these stories that keep going on. But also for us in the media, it's going to be good because we can move on and start covering newer news. The important thing here is that there's just a lot of doubt. There are a lot of questions. You go in front of a touchscreen machine, you press a button, and it's a total act of faith. And when you do recounts, you basically ask the machine to tell you if it told the truth, if it got it right. And the machine says, yes, of course I got it right. So what we had in Sarasota in November, in the race, ironically, to replace Catherine Harris, she of 2000 right. Secretary of State fame, is that you had 18,000 people cast what are called undervotes or no votes in a race that was one of the most hotly contested in the nation, one of the most expensive in the nation. And it really was probably the final straw that just led to a lawsuit, led people to say, you know what, let's just have something on paper so if Florida voters who are notoriously finicky or tricky or sometimes not into paying attention, if they somehow make a mistake, you have a paper record, a primary paper record, to check their voter intent. The doubts about whether the machine ate my vote, the computer ate my vote, have finally grown too strong for most people to ignore.
Crist campaigned on providing money for stem cell research. In office, he did announce $20 million for stem cell research, but he's not including embryonic stem cell research.
Correct, and that was embryonic stem cell research that he said he supported. But he's a pragmatist. He's a creature of the legislature. He was a state senator a while ago, and he understands that he doesn't want to fight this. He knows that the Republican legislature probably won't sign off on it. He's probably pushed the envelope far enough on moving the Republican Party back to the center that this is not a battle that he really wants to pick.
Healthcare, here in Massachusetts, lawmakers passed a plan to increase the number of people with health care last year. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger went one better in California, proposing universal health care.
Crist might move in that direction. We asked him about it. He said, sounds interesting. We said, well, what about the children of illegal immigrants? Maybe, he says. He doesn't rule anything out.
Mark Caputo, where do you see the new Governor Crist possibly being part of a national conversation?
Well, the most interesting thing is all these states are trying to move their primaries earlier. And Florida is one of them. Florida's demanding it become a player now. But as for Crist himself, Crist is this face of the new Republican Party that you see with Arnold Schwarzenegger, you see with Rudy Giuliani, and, well, it used to be with John McCain, although he's moving farther to the right now, is that he's a very centrist, populist Republican governor. And he's got good ties to both Giuliani and McCain. So he'll likely be an endorsement that's worth having. He's not a Jeb Bush, but his favorability ratings are around the same level of Jeb Bush's, which were always very, very high, the envy of many governors.
Mark Caputo covers Florida politics for the Miami Herald, and thankfully for him, he covers an interesting governor there, Governor Crist. Mark, thank you for speaking with us.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us.
And let's take a quick look at other state houses. Virginia's Tim Kaine said the state's number one problem is traffic congestion, but also called for a minimum wage above the federal level. In Georgia, a reelected Republican governor announced Go Fish Georgia, a $19 million economic plan. And here in Massachusetts, Governor Deval Patrick is calling for a volunteer force to work on community projects. Well, still ahead, the Reverend Ted Haggard says he's cured of homosexuality. Is that possible? It's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today's Denver Post reports that Reverend Ted Haggard has emerged from 3 weeks of counseling convinced he is completely heterosexual. You may recall that Haggard resigned last year from leading the National Association of Evangelicals and was fired from his Colorado church after confessing to a 3-year cash-for-sex affair with a former male prostitute. Haggard had preached that homosexuality was wrong and soon after underwent what evangelicals call restoration counseling to, as they describe it, cure homosexuality. The process is called reparative therapy by the American Psychiatric Association. And joining us from New York City to talk about it is Dr. Jack Drescher, a psychiatrist who is also former chair of the American Psychiatric Association's Committee on Gay, Lesbian, and Bisexual Issues. And Dr. Drescher, how do most psychiatric professionals view reparative therapy?
Well, the American Psychiatric Association has issued position statements, first in 1998 and then in the year 2000, expressing concern about these kinds of treatments because of the possible harm that they might do.
How so?
Well, people who go into these treatments, first of all, a lot of the treatments are being done by non-professionals. Some unlicensed professionals are doing this. That's one concern. So it's not a very well-regulated industry, as we think. It's certainly not as well-regulated as the medical profession. And another concern is that because the people who offer these kinds of treatments usually claim that it is the motivation or faith of the patient or client which will determine whether or not they will have a positive outcome, and even though what passes in their literature for reviews of their of what they do says that the majority don't change, you find that people go in, and since the majority don't change, when they've been told that it's up to them whether they will change, most people who don't come out of this feeling like it was their fault.
Yeah, that they had somehow not succeeded in changing themselves. What exactly happens in the counseling? Do you know?
Basically, the therapist, when it's done by a therapist, sometimes a lot of this is done in self-help groups, the therapist explains to the patient the therapist's theory of why the patient has homosexual feelings. Even though today nobody really knows what causes homosexuality, the therapists who do these kinds of treatments claim that they do have this knowledge, and then they explain to the patient why they were gay. Usually one of the theories is that they didn't have a good relationship with a parent of the same sex, and that they're confused, that they're not really looking for sex with someone of the same sex, they're actually looking for affection. So the idea is they explain to the patient, you're really confused about that. And so they try and re-educate the patient how to have non-sexual relations with someone of the same gender, and then to try to help them inhibit their sexual desires by talking about it as if it was something wrong that needs to be gotten rid of.
Well, Dr. Drescher, I know that within moments we're going to hear from a listener who will say that, in fact, they did go through this process and they were, quote unquote, cured of their homosexual feelings and it did work. Are there occasions where someone can go into this intensive therapy, 3-week therapy in Reverend Haggard's case, and not have the homosexual urgings anymore?
I have never doubted the veracity of anybody who came up and said, I was once homosexual and now I'm not, because I don't know what's in the hearts and minds of people who I've not directly examined myself. But there is a linguistic problem that I do notice in my review of the literature and tapes of people who say these things, which is that many people, once they decide they no longer want to be gay, they often describe themselves already as ex-gay. That is, within the theological perspective that they're using, or sometimes a therapeutic perspective, just rejecting a gay identity is the beginning of the process. But, you know, nobody has ever done a study to test somebody before they started the process and after they were finished whether or not a change had actually taken place. And the other issue, I think, is that in a sense, for example, you know, just from reading what Hagrid's spokesperson said to the public, I would say that he's basically saying something that falls along the lines of the beliefs of his group. They do not believe that there is such a thing as a homosexual person. They really believe that everybody is heterosexual and that one engages in homosexuality as a sin. As a result of that, once you've renounced the sin, then you're back to being a heterosexual. So from that religious theological perspective, he's being totally honest, because from their perspective, there is only heterosexuality. There is no such thing as a homosexual or gay identity.
Well, and Dr. Drescher, again, the scientific community would be where on this? Because you did say in passing that no one really knows what gives someone homosexual feelings. But is it thought that there is a genetic component to homosexuality?
We don't know what causes homosexuality. There are certainly good studies that show that there is some element of genetics involved, but we don't know what they are. Probably not one gene.
But does your community agree that there is homosexuality, that it isn't just a heterosexual who has...
No. The scientific community and the mental health community accepts that there is such a thing as a gay person, people with gay, lesbian, bisexual identities, whose sexuality is as normal and natural to them as heterosexual sexuality is to them.
We want to make sure his overseers also urged Hagrid to go into a 12-step program for sexual addiction. That's quite a separate topic, isn't it, than the restoration counseling?
Well, among anti-homosexual groups, homosexuality is often conceptualized as something like a sexual addiction. So actually, from their perspective, not again from the mainstream perspective, that would be consistent with their way of thinking about homosexuality.
But treating sexual addiction is something that many psychiatrists do separately.
Well, sexual addiction is not a formal diagnosis in the psychiatric diagnostic manual. There are people who do have compulsive sexual behaviors. There is controversy whether that is an addiction like a drug addiction or whether that is something else.
Right.
That's not really clear.
And one very last question. Last night I just happened to tune into the program Boston Legal, and the storyline was that someone had SSAD, as they called it, same-sex attraction disorder, or SAD.
That's a made-up diagnosis by people who do reparative therapies. There's no official diagnosis.
Right.
It's something that they've, instead of calling it homosexuality, they call it same-sex attraction disorder.
Well, the program made quite a bit of fun of it, you know, saying, you know, to this person, well, actually, you're gay. And he said, no, I'm not. I have this disorder. And that's art, perhaps, or entertainment and fun for some. But how damaging is this to people who really are, you know, struggling with issues, to have a news story like this come out? What impact is a news story like the Reverend Hagrid's from your point of view?
Well, from my point of view, the whole ex-gay movement is being presented to the general public in a marketing kind of way, that the people who are promoting these kinds of treatments are really not making their case within professional circles. They're making their case directly to the public, and they're saying, the mental health professions have failed you. We can do this for you. They don't have to do it, prove it scientifically. They don't have to do real research. So they are selling hope. And I would say in many cases they are selling false hope. And I unfortunately have the position of saying, you know, read very carefully that contract that you're signing, because you may be buying a pig in a poke.
Dr. Jack Drescher, former chair of the American Psychiatric Association's Committee on Gay, Lesbian, and Bisexual Issues. Dr. Drescher, thanks so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you.
And a quick program note, tomorrow we'll hear from Tony Award-winning actress Cherry Jones on taking the Pulitzer Prize-winning play Doubt on the road. That's tomorrow. You're listening to Here and Now. From Detroit to San Francisco, more and more zoos are closing their elephant exhibits. The latest is Philadelphia. The nation's oldest zoo has had elephants since it opened in 1874. Susan Phillips, a producer for WHYY in Philadelphia, explains why Philly has to send its pachyderms packing.
Maybe that's the mommy and the daddy.
You think that's the mommy and the daddy one?
Yeah.
On a warm, sunny day at the Philadelphia Zoo, African elephants Bet, Callie, and Petal stand inside a fenced-in patch of dirt. While Callie tries to scratch her ear with a log, Bet digs a hole and Petal rubs herself against the wall of a stone barn. Aside from a wading pool, there's not much else for them to do.
Look, 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 Anna, look! What are they doing?
I don't know.
Are they trying to kiss and their tusks are getting in the way? Oh my gosh, aren't they beautiful?
Kids love the elephants at the zoo. But do the elephants love the zoo? At Philadelphia Zoo, four elephants share 2,000 square feet of space inside a barn. Zoo officials tried to raise money to expand the area but came up short. At about the same time, animal rights activists launched a campaign to shut down the exhibit, saying it was too small and lacked sufficient stimulation. And between the protests and the lack of funding, they succeeded. Callie, Bet, and Petal will be leaving in the spring.
If you don't have an elephant, then you don't have a zoo.
8-year-old Connor Stewart and 7-year-old Justin Weiss will be sad to see the elephants go.
So do you know why they're leaving?
Because they were fighting when I was here.
Did you see them fight?
Yeah.
Wow.
They were charging at each other.
Seriously, where?
Yeah, they were.
Oh my gosh, sad.
Philadelphia's elephants will be heading to Baltimore, because the zoo there is spending $5 million to expand its elephant exhibit to 6 acres, including a quarter-mile walking trek, complete with watering hole, salt lick, and mud wallow.
What we've done as a united group of elephant keepers in zoos is we've decided that we have to make a commitment to these animals and care for them properly, and there's no doing it halfway.
Mike McClure is the collection manager of elephants with the Maryland Zoo in Baltimore. He says elephant keeping has changed over the years.
Initially, when zoos first opened 100 years ago, there were small exhibits for elephants. Now, what we found is we need to provide them much more space, which we are doing. But I think the current trend, even more so than providing them space, is realizing that these are not just animals that just need to be put on huge amounts of acreage and just left to sit in one spot or another. You also need to stimulate them, provide opportunities that they would get in the wild, provide the same sorts of things that they would encounter, you know, if they were out in the wild in Africa walking around.
But many animal rights activists, including Marianne Bessie from Friends of Philly Zoo Elephants, say the elephants should be left in the wild. Putting elephants in captivity, she says, no matter how large the area, is missing the point.
One thing zoos always claim is that it's unfair for American children not to be able to see an elephant up close and personal. Well, really, we're cheating American children by putting these elephants on display in these unnatural circumstances. We're depriving them of really seeing a real elephant. We're just showing them just something that might look like an elephant, but it's certainly not behaving like an elephant.
Elephants are in danger in Africa and Asia as their habitat shrinks and contact with humans increases. The Association of Zoos and Aquariums defends elephant captivity, saying the more than 280 elephants in their accredited zoos are healthy. Critics say they suffer from joint and foot problems.
I also know that they're veterinarians, and they eat 300 pieces of grass and 500 gallons of water at a time.
Zoo visitor Danielle Wasson made sure her family got one last look at the elephants before they leave Philadelphia.
We're actually visiting from California. We used to live here before, but we wanted to come to the zoo and take my daughter because it's the last time that she'll be able to see the elephants. I just think they're just gentle and gorgeous creatures. They're really neat. Definitely something I'll never see outside of a zoo. And I'm glad that they're taking them somewhere where they'll be better cared for. They need more open range and all.
Callie, Bet, and Petal will move to Baltimore this spring. Dolari, the zoo's Asian elephant, will be heading to the Elephant Sanctuary in Tennessee.
Susan Phillips in Philadelphia. For more on elephants and zoos, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. Music and food for thought on Valentine's Day. That's still ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. If music be the food of love, play on. Shakespeare, Twelfth Night, Act 1, Scene 1. And if it's Valentine's Day, play Bill Evans and Jim Hall and eat something made with love. With only a week to go until the holiday, we thought we'd bring in a couple of our beloved Here and Now experts to talk food and music. The food part, that would be Here and Now's resident chef, Kathy Gunst. Welcome as always, Kathy.
Hi, Robin.
And for the music, who else? Here and Now jazz aficionado, James Isaacs.
Hello, Robin.
Welcome to you as well. And let's start with this music. There are so many versions. Why'd you pick this one?
Because of the interactive value between Bill Evans' piano and Jim Hall's guitar. The interplay between the two instruments is just so extraordinary. And by the way, what you just heard is an alternate take. The master is taken a little bit faster. And as I recall, when this album came out in 1962, reviewers said that the up-tempo version of My Funny Valentine, usually, of course, taken as a very slow ballad, that Evans and Hall came up with something entirely fresh and new, which they did.
Kathy, when we said Valentine's Day to you, you said...
Oysters.
Sure you did. Is it true? Do they have some sort of aphrodisiac quality? Has that been proven?
Well, the Romans documented oysters as an aphrodisiac as early as the 2nd century A.D. I clearly wasn't there. I can tell you that it's pretty sexy food. There's kind of that cleansing, refreshing, renewing, and very sensual kind of feeling of slurping down this raw, briny oyster.
By the way, can you... I think people are a little intimidated by this. Can you buy them and bring them home? I think people are worried about that.
What you want to do is, if you're going to be serving them on Valentine's night, you want to go late in the afternoon. You want to go to the fish store. You want to call ahead and say, I don't know how to open these things. So you have two options. You can either ask for a very quick lesson, and it is tough to open them. Ask them to open them for you, but don't have them sit around for more than 2 or 3 hours. Fresh squeeze of lemon, little bit of chopped shallots with a white wine or a champagne vinegar drizzled over a raw oyster. Very nice.
James, let's underscore the thought of having oysters for Valentine's with your next music pick.
Well, our next tune, of course, is You're Not the Only Oyster in the Stew, which was recorded in 1934 by the great pianist, songwriter, and singer Thomas Fats Waller. However, this tune was not written by Fats Waller. It was written by Johnny Burke and Harold Spina. Now, of course, Valentine's Day ain't for everyone. There are the brokenhearted out there, and there are those who might be singing You Aren't the Only Oyster in the Stew. But here is the eternally insouciant and ebullient Thomas Fats Waller.
You're not the only oyster in the stew. Not the only tea leaf in the tea. However, I'm convinced, completely, fully, firmly convinced, you're the only one for me. You're not the only wriggle in the prune. You're not the only apple on the tree.
Well, Kathy, James reminds us that on Valentine's Day there will be those who will be humming that tune and, you know, trying to have a good time and sending a message to someone else that, you know, who cares? And by the way, there might be people who find oysters disgusting. I mean, we understand that, too. There are some people who don't eat oysters. But what do you have for somebody who is recovering from a broken heart?
Well, you know, the truth is that really paying attention to good, fresh food is an act of love. And it's an act of love to the self. So whether you're sharing it with someone you adore, whether you're sitting there by yourself, make the food delicious. I have a recipe that I adore for beef short ribs, which are very inexpensive, incredibly tender. And I do a stew with an orange hoisin ginger sauce with bok choy, which will be on the website. You cook this for yourself. You cook this for someone you love. And there's just no doubting that you're being good to yourself.
And as you said, cook it for yourself if you're the person you love, if there's no one else there. But what about for vegetarians?
Well, how about a wild mushroom risotto? There are all kinds of fabulous farm-raised wild mushrooms in the market now. Chop some of these up with some good Italian rice, a short, stubby arborio rice with vegetable broth. Risotto is also a wonderful dish to cook with a friend right. or a loved one because you stir and stir and stir, and it's a slow, easy cook. You will be well rewarded at the end.
With a good meal, of course, I think you're referring to.
Well, you use your imagination.
Well, speaking of which, the gifts that are given on Valentine's Day, James, I know you have a song that reflects one.
Well, Robin, one of the traditional Valentine's Day gifts is, of course, candy. Mm-hmm. And I've selected a song written in 1944 by Mac David, Joan Whitney, and Alex Kramer called Candy. It's sung here by the late and, to my ears, great Big Maybelle. She was born Maybelle Smith. And I think she is a very underrated singer. Big Maybelle sang rhythm and blues and blues with jazz inflections, and for years she was a headliner at the famous Apollo Theater in New York. Big Maybelle died in 1972 at age 48. Here's just a taste of her greatness.
Candy, why I call my sugar candy. I'm sweet on candy, and candy, he's sweet on me. He understands me. Yes, my understanding, candy.
Big Maybelle singing Candy, which Kathy brings us to dessert. And I'm noticing you don't have chocolate here.
I get really sick of the whole Valentine's Day and chocolate. I think of those Whitman samplers, and it's like cliche, cliche, cliche. So what I did was I made a vanilla and Meyer lemon panna cotta. Meyer lemon, which are these outstanding winter lemons. They started in California. Some people say they're a cross between an orange and a lemon. It's a much more intense flavor. The reason I chose this for Valentine's Day is that the texture is so silky smooth and truly sensual. And again, share it. It's easy to make.
Well, I'm not sharing this.
Oh, and I forgot to mention I drizzled it with my husband's very own maple syrup. Mm. You know, the thing about really good food, too, is when you share it with someone you love, it tastes even better because you're in that intoxicated state of being in love and with someone. And I can't think of anything better. Well, just about anything better than eating truly good food and panna cotta with Meyer lemon and vanilla. Man, that'll brighten February for anybody.
Well, it being Valentine's Day, people do think of something better eventually. And James, you have something to underscore that, the music for the late night.
Yeah, Robin, I do. I thought that we'd go out on a tune that expresses really what Valentine's Day is about. It's the Isley Brothers from 1975, and it's their song called For the Love of You. And what is sweeter on Valentine's Day than some sweet soul music?
I wanna be living for the love of you. All right now, all that I'm giving is for the love of you. You got me, girl.
The Isley Brothers. James Isaacs, you're looking at me kind of funny.
It's working.
We've been talking about food and music for Valentine's Day with jazz aficionado James Isaacs and Here and Now's resident chef Kathy Gunst. We'll have the music and the recipes at our website, here-now.org. Have a wonderful Valentine's Day. And who am I kidding? I'll be asleep by 7 o'clock.
But you're happy now,
right? I am.
Robin, go to sleep to some music.
I will, after I have my panna cotta.
I see, oh, I see. Ooh, now
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
To try to say what I feel, yeah. Love is real, oh, love is real. Ooh. I might as well sign my name on a card.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.